It's been a challenging 18 months now. 2023 was like a reckoning.
They don't have a warm intro. What is it that gets your attention?
Founders need to try and be creative in how they reach investors.
Of course, you're sat in your ivory tower. You know, it's cushy for you. You sat on all these millions to deploy.
Look, I think many people kind of like immediately put the blame on VCs. I also don't think all VCs are created equal.
Black Mirror.
100%, yeah. There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of concern. I think a lot of it is justified. I think things are moving so quickly right now, and there's just a lot of unknowns. We're already connected to technology, but could we actually shift the way we're connected and have it be like a bigger part of us, but less distracting part of us? It was sheer traction. You just saw it in the numbers. The founders I tend to get most excited about have...
Welcome to another weekly episode of Strategy and Tragedy, the show that spotlights the highs and lows of starting, scaling, and even exiting your own business. If this is your first time tuning in, then as a quick introduction to your host, I'm Stephanie Melodier, and for 6 years, I ran an award-winning marketing agency for startups and scale-ups. Over that time, we worked with over 100 founders and their scaling teams, which of course put me in a privileged position of hearing everyone's stories, including their trials and tribulations. Little did they know that they were all experiencing the same challenges. As I was the one at the epicenter of all those conversations, I was obviously privy to certain themes and patterns, which is one of the main reasons why I started this show. Strategy and Tragedy, as the name suggests, is all about sharing both the highs and lows of business, because entrepreneurship, even for the most level-headed among us, is a roller coaster. Entrepreneurship has also been overly glamorized in recent years. Yes, it can be extremely rewarding and you get to make an impact on the world whilst making money and growing a team, but that's not to say that it's not without its challenges. And boy, those challenges are tough. We've also experienced seismic shifts over the past decade, not only in our startup ecosystem since that term was first coined in Silicon Valley, but in the world at large. I mean, we literally had a global pandemic, banks collapse, wars break out. You cannot make this stuff up, but you already know that. So it's with this backdrop that I started the show to share with you the most important lessons learned and practical, actionable tips from entrepreneurs, investors, and subject matter experts telling it how it is to help you in your business journey too. Yes, you're a trailblazer, but it doesn't mean you have to make the same mistakes that many others have done before you. To hear more about the philosophy behind Strategy and Tragedy, I strongly recommend you bookmark episode 0, which says start here, to listen to straight after this episode. It's only 6 minutes long, and at double speed, it means it's only 3 minutes of context for you. With all that being said, I am so excited to get on with this show and interview my next guest. Ziv Reichardt, a partner at Local Globe, the early stage VC firm behind the likes of Citymapper, Wise, and Zoopla. Ziv, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So I'd love to kick off with a proper introduction. So I mentioned that you're a partner at Local Globe. Tell us what that actually means. What do you do at Local Globe?
Yeah, so look, essentially what I do as a partner in the investment team is, you know, try and source really compelling opportunities. And then, you know, when I assess kind of like an ocean of opportunities, really decide what we want to pick and actually back. And post-investment, really work with those teams to help them build, you know, the generational companies of the next decade. So it means really kind of like meeting as many companies as we can, you know, building relationships with founders, and then ultimately kind of like backing them on the journey that, you know, is going to be kind of decade plus and, you know, and kind of the years ahead.
And getting through those doors is on the top of everyone's minds at the moment. It feels like it's harder than ever before to get through the doors, especially at a top VC firm like Local Globe. So what's your kind of take on how difficult it's been to get fundraising for founders these days?
Look, I mean, it's been a challenging 12, 18, 24 months now. You know, I think post kind of like 2020, 2021, I think 2022, 2023 was like a reckoning. And I think we're still kind of like working our way through that. Look, I think getting through the door into kind of like a meeting with a venture hasn't changed that much. I think, you know, building relationships with people who know the investors or the investors themselves tends to play dividends. And I think, you know, VCs tend to meet people who kind of like proactively try to get to them. That doesn't mean we don't kind of like reply to cold emails, but ultimately when you have hundreds and hundreds of inbound messages, you know, every week, you have to just kind of like make a choice. Like, how do you prioritize, you know, who you actually engage with? And so
let's stick with that for a sec. Sorry. So tip for founders is like, be persistent, like definitely make that proactive, like outreach, but how can they get a response if they send you a cold email, if they're not, they don't have a warm intro, what is it that gets your attention?
Look, I think many people kind of like immediately put the blame on VCs. Like, why don't you respond to every like email that you get, every like message that you get on LinkedIn? The reality is it's virtually impossible. Maybe in a world where we'll have like AI agents that do the work on our behalf, like that will be more realistic.
Could you just quickly give us an idea, like on average, how many LinkedIn messages, emails do you get in like a week?
It honestly varies, but you know, it's probably like several dozen, and I think several dozen across the team. Now, keep in mind, like you have your calendar kind of like packed back-to-back meetings with founders, and more than anything, you're there to support your own portfolio companies, and that takes the bulk of your time. And so, again, going back to what we were talking about, that doesn't mean we don't reply to cold inbound. And you know, we read through every message that we get, but in a world of finite time, you have to make choices. And so I do think founders need to try and be creative in how they reach investors. Mm-hmm. And that's just the reality. So you can try and DM someone on LinkedIn. You can then try and DM them on X. And if that doesn't work, like go and see who is connected to that individual and try and get like a warm route in.
What's been the most creative outreach that a founder's done for you? Who's got your attention?
Look, it's a good question. Nothing comes top of mind right now, but I think being very intentional with the message that you send tends to really stick out. So I think it's very easy to discern what's a very general, broad message versus something that's been very targeted towards our firm and more than our firm, to me specifically as an investor. So if you're keen to chat, you know, what have I written? What have I kind of like shown interest in that, you know, leads you to believe that you're built, you know, will lead me to believe you're kind of building something that's exciting and, you know, like want me to kind of jump in a call.
It's like job hunting, isn't it? Like if you tailor the cover letter, if you've done your research on the company, like you're obviously going to stand out more than other applicants.
I think that's right. Look, I think the main point I think is important to just bring across is that you often just hear people blaming investors for not responding for, you know, to every message. And I think that's just like wishful thinking. And that's not to say we don't want to, it's just virtually impossible. Mm. And so just be creative. I think that's like a really important thing to emphasize.
It's so funny. It's just making me smile so much because, I don't know, like we all need someone to blame. It's so frustrating. It's so tough sometimes. And I think there's something there with the power dynamic with, you know, the people who have got the money, like the money men. Yeah. It's almost like, well, you know, you're sat in your ivory tower, you know, it's cushy for you. You've sat on all these millions, hundreds of millions to deploy. So it's just that kind of like,
it's true.
Shaking the fist at someone, and the people who've got the money are the easy targets, aren't they?
Yeah.
Does that bother you then, like on a personal level? Does that get to you? Do you want to change that narrative?
The power dynamics of venture. I guess
more just, you know, looking to blame, like it's easy to blame VCs.
Look, I think it's kind of like part of it. I don't think we need to change it. I also don't think all VCs are created equal. I've not been in the kind of seat of a founder. And I know that having spoken with many founders, I have a lot of founder friends. I work with many, like it's not easy. And not all VCs treat founders in a very amicable way. And so I think in many cases, VCs have earned their, have earned the kind of like...
A few bad apples have spoiled it for the bunch, right?
I think so. I think that's kind of like fair to say. So look, I'm not here to change the narrative, but I think as Local Globe, you know, that's kind of the way we think about it. I mean, we would love to respond to every founder. We would like to kind of give ample time to meet with every founder that's building something, but it's just kind of like unrealistic. But when we do... you know, kind of like make a commitment to meet with a founder and we mm-hmm. spend 30 minutes or an hour with them, we will always try and get back with as much context or feedback as to why we're not progressing if we decide not to progress. Mm-hmm. And if we do want to progress, we'll try and give as much context as to what the process looks like. And we'll try to run a quick process so we don't waste their time and hold them up. So I think for us, being respectful for what founders go through and, you know, as you kind of put it earlier, like the difficult journey the founders are on, I mean, that's kind of like critical for us. So, you know, we try to think about founders, you know, all the time.
Yeah. You touched on the VC buzzword at the moment that's on the tips of everyone's tongues, AI, which we'll definitely come onto in a second. It may well be part of the next answer that I, question that I ask you. What are you excited about? You talk about those people who do make it through. So you've got, in terms of practical tips, you know, be intentional with your outreach, do your research. But in terms of the businesses, the sectors, what's getting you excited? AI, the buzzword, might come back into it again. But what's getting your attention these days?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think, you know, I'd lie if I wouldn't say what's happening in the world of AI isn't exciting. But frankly, AI is basically kind of like everywhere and everything. So it's almost difficult to say AI. You know, it's like every business that we meet has an AI component to it at this point. And, you know, frankly, if I look at Local Globe and what we've been doing, we've been investing in AI for the last decades. We have 50 or so AI first companies and, you know, the kind of like space has changed. There's been like amazing technological advancements and we remain very excited about what's going to be kind of like unlocked over the kind of like next 12, 24, you know, months. Me specifically, you know, I'm interested in a couple of different areas that, you know, touch AI, don't touch AI. The first is, you know, immersive technology. So kind of spatial computing, if you kind of like think about what Apple is calling it, but the notion that we will be more connected to technology going forward. And I think you can kind of like break down immersive in different ways. One could be actual wearable computing like the Vision Pro or the Quest 3 and the sorts of things that will be kind of built on top of that. The other kind of like way to think about immersive is just technology that is always on and on you. And so there's been like a really interesting wave of new consumer AI kind of hardware products come to light. So companies like Rabbit or companies like Tab or Rewind, Brilliant, et cetera. So not necessarily immersive in the sense that you're kind of like in a 3D or virtual world, but immersive in the sense that you're always connected to technology and it's augmenting your day-to-day life in a kind of like positive way.
So what do those companies you just listed, what do they do?
So, I mean, look, all of them are kind of pretty early, but if you think about something like Tab, it's an early stage company, I think based out in New York. It's a wearable, you know, pendant that you kind of like put on top, I mean, I guess around your neck. It records like all your daily interactions. So, you know, it would record this conversation. It would record my conversation with my wife, et cetera. And I'd be able to go and ask questions. What did I talk about my wife, you know, last Thursday? Or, you know, what did we argue about? How could I have, you know, acted, you know, better? How could I have responded to her kind of like challenge in a more kind of like empathetic way. So, you know, it's immersive in the sense that it's kind of like always on and it starts to augment your life and unlock a new kind of layer of utility.
I'm just going to jump in here really quickly, apologies, but the obvious response to this, and I'm sure this is on every single listener's mind right now, Black Mirror are the two words.
100%, yeah.
And not only that, you know, generally in terms of the AI space and what's happening, but this specific example, there literally was one particular episode yeah. that was exactly about that. So what are your views? What would you respond to? You know, I feel like the world is very divided on that front, very much, you know, 50-50, this is exciting, we're embracing these new technologies, we're at the dawn of this new era, imagine all of the applications, how much easier it can make our life, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other half, if not more, I would say actually, are scared, are like, oh my God, this is Black Mirror, this yeah. is reality, what's becoming of us, it's coming to take our jobs, et cetera, et cetera. I presume you land more on the former side of things. I'd love to hear more on your thoughts around, you know, combating some of people's fears, actually like the maybe the more positive opportunities with AI at the moment?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of concern. I think a lot of it is justified. I think things are moving so quickly right now and there's just a lot of unknowns and that creates fear. And I'm very kind of sympathetic to people's kind of like feelings at this point. I mean, I have these conversations with my wife you know, it scares her. And I think that's very fair. I think, you know, you have to think about what this ultimately unlocks to people beyond ourselves. I think, you know, it's pretty, you know, important to sit and think, like, what does this mean for the future of, you know, healthcare? Or what does this mean for the future of, you know, the democratization of education? I mean, one of the companies that I work with at Local Globe is a business called Fundamate, which is based out in South Africa, and they've been building LLM-powered tutors over the last 3 years. So initially kind of on top of GPT-2, then on top of BERT, and they've scaled to, you know, 3.5 million users now, really trying to democratize access to high-quality teaching across the world's emerging markets. And so it's very kind of like convenient and easy to sit here and say, like, I don't want this to kind of like become the norm or the default, or this is going to take, but the reality is, like, there's many people in the world that don't have, like, good access to, you know, preventative healthcare or, like, high quality access or kind of like access to high quality education. I do think we're shifting to a world where there will be abundance of high quality whatever. And so to me, that's very, very exciting. I think the one needs to note is, you know, if we go back to the conversation on some of these new hardware products, whether it's kind of like Tab or Rewind or kind of like Rabbit, I think there may very well be a shift in the form factor of the kind of mobile device we've grown accustomed to over the last 10 to 15 years, which is like the smartphone, which is like a 6-inch device that, by the way, is wearable. We are holding our phones like the entire day. We're, you know, like on it all the time. And so I think there may very well be a world in which we shift to something that's more wearable, whether it's kind of like smart glasses or like wearable watches, whatever, that actually limits the amount of time we interact with screens. And we are actually more present and engaged in the moment. And to me, that's exciting. And so it's not really about, oh, we're going to be like connect. We're already connected to technology. But could we actually shift the way we're kind of connected to technology and have it be like a bigger part of us, but less distracting part of us, which I think is certainly the case. And so I guess kind of like a quick shift to your question, you know, about the areas I'm excited about, like immersive tech is one area. Technical or technological detox is another, because I'm very mindful of the fact that most of us are now like total junkies. And, you know, I'll be the first to raise my hand and say, I'm one.
It's kind of like those ads in the 40s, 50s for smoking, right? And you'd have these campaigns of how it's like good for your health and so glamorized. And then you look back, you're like, oh my God, I wonder if the same sort of thing would happen now with our phones and technology. People look back and be like, oh my God, they spent all these hours with these devices in their hands, glued to their eyes, glued to the screens. I love that. Ziv, you've already made me feel a bit more optimistic about the way that we're going. So you mentioned Tab, Rewind, Rabbit. I presume these aren't part of the Local Globe portfolio. No. They're just brands you admire. What companies in the portfolio are you excited about? Do you have any favorites?
Look, I think it's hard to pick favorites. I mean, I work with a couple of companies that I obviously, you know, love to work with, love the founding teams, think they're doing something very, very special. I mean, I alluded to Fundamate. I think that's a very special business. You know, as I mentioned, building kind of an LLM-powered tutor for the world's emerging markets started a couple of years back. We backed them when they had, you know, 150,000 users. They've since scaled to, you know, 3 or 3.5 million. So like real viral growth.
If we stick with these guys for a sec, can we break down the key ingredients that make this an exciting company for you? So you've got the fact that they've got LLM, AI, they're in the right space. They've got a clear mission that has positive social impact. Is there anything else about their strategy, their team, the founders on that positive? I'm going to go negative in a sec, but on this positive front for a minute.
Look, so first of all, you know, they were observing advancements in NLP, you know, large language models or language models for, you know, a couple of years pre the ChatGPT moment. So I think it goes back to that like insight piece. Like, what do you know that the rest of the market doesn't? It's very obvious now that, you know, language models unlock a ton of opportunities. But Descartes and Teo, the founders, were able to see that a couple of years before.
And then how do you decipher as an investor whether there actually is something there, whether there is that potential versus this crazy visionary, or even if there is something, how long is it going to take? Because it's that whole crystal ball that you need as an investor to back these innovative companies.
Yeah, look, I think it's a good question. I think it's dependent on the sort of business. I think in the case of Fundimate, it was sheer traction. You know, you just saw it in the numbers. You know, they were using, you know, when we first met them, I think GPT-2 or BERT, but, you know, like people were just like using the product. They were engaged, heavily engaged, and they were sharing it nonstop. And so you'd see all growth was organic. So look, I think not every company that we meet at the early stages shows this level of traction, but with Fundimate, it was very clear that they were onto something. And it was very clear, speaking with people working in the field of AI, that language models were going to get better and better. And so if you look at that level of engagement with, you know, BERT, and you're like, okay, what's going to happen in like a year or 2 years or 3 years? You're like, okay, this could be really, really exciting. And what happened is, you know, ChatGPT launched, and then GPT-4 came out, and then Gemini, et cetera. And so the product has been able to ride on these huge technical advances. And I think it's really kind of like day one. So again, it was like a mix of insight that was really ahead of the market. And so look, we meet a lot of companies in the education space looking to do similar things, but all of them have started over the last 6 to 12 months. And by the way, like I'm sure many of them are going to be able to build really compelling businesses. But what attracted me here was learning something that was totally, totally new, at least new to me.
So these guys were ahead of the curve a few years ago. And are you saying now these other AI startups in the past 6 months are kind of behind the curve?
I wouldn't say behind the curves. I just think it's more obvious. Mm. It's more obvious that the opportunity exists. And again, you know, like the market is still largely up for grabs. Like the race is on. No one knows who's going to win. There's probably going to be multiple big players emerge in kind of the education space, including some of the incumbents. But what really attracted me here was the fact that they were able to see that ahead of everyone else. And frankly, we didn't know ChatGPT is going to get released like 2 years after our investment. And it did. And so that was really compelling. The other thing is just the founder story. And I think it always comes down to the founder story. I think, you know, when we invest in companies at the early stages with LocalGlo, we look for, you know, frankly, two things. It's like, is it an interesting market? And do we think there's an opportunity to build a venture scale business? And B, and you know, that's where we spend the bulk of our time, do we think this is the team to actually do it?
Deliver on that.
And so, you know, if I go back to the Fundimate example, you know, Descartes and Theo, both, you know, super young, first time, hungry founders. Descartes came from literally a village in the northern part of South Africa, 70 kids in a school, teacher showed up 50% of the time, didn't have a computer until he was, I don't know, in his kind of late teens. You know, managed to kind of like get some money together, buy a secondhand or build a secondhand computer, graduated top of his class, got into the University of Cape Town, first one in the history of the school, studied computer science, and then met Theo, who was an economic grad that was studying, you know, literacy or illiteracy rates across the country. And the two realized that, you know, there's actually a big opportunity in using language models to, you know, democratize access to education. Up until then, Theo thought the best way to do it is to actually like buy a ton of books or textbooks, like hold them up in trucks and kind of like drive those trucks around the country. And I think when Descartes told her what can be done with language models, I think her mind totally shifted. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like a very organic story. Someone that's really felt the pain himself had, you know, a unique point of view and insight and then decided to go and do it before they raise any money. And I think that's the other thing. It's like, go and build and then go and raise money. And I think that is also like, and look, I'm also kind of like mindful of the fact that that doesn't work for every business. Some sort of companies just require capital upfront in order to get things moving. But I think in certain instances like Fundimate, like you can just build this, try and get it out, validate that people want this, and then go and like think about fundraising.
Each of those co-founders sound like such inspirational individuals in their own right, but you bring them together and it's this peanut butter and chocolate combination that just sounds unstoppable. I can feel your excitement. This company sounds amazing, so I definitely want to check them out as well. Quick one, I need to tell you a bit about Patreon. If you haven't heard of it before, Patreon is the creator platform that enables people like you to support podcasters like me. I actually studied art history for all of 5 minutes, which is where the whole idea of patronage, aka financially supporting artists, comes from. kings and queens would commission artists to create paintings to adorn their castle walls. Upper class lords and ladies celebrated their accomplishments by using their wealth to support the arts. And during the Italian Renaissance, my favorite era, the Medicis actually developed a close bond with Michelangelo, who painted the Sistine Chapel, and the Sforza family supported Da Vinci, who helped name Leonardo DiCaprio. That is a true story, by the way. Anyway, I know that you're not here for a history lesson thrown in to your business studies class, but if you're feeling like a rich Renaissance royal who wants to support your very own little Botticelli here, then Patreon is the solution for you. Simply tap the link in the show notes to select your tier of patronage to support the show. It starts from a low amount and it really means a lot to help me to continue producing these interviews that I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for listening. Let's get back into the episode. Coming back on your point around, you know, obvious, you know, these startups that are emerging now, AI, such a buzzword. Like, as an investor with that crystal ball mindset, what do you read, listen to, follow that helps foster more of that future thinking mindset? Like, how do you train your brain to be able to spot those opportunities that are ahead of the curve before they become obvious to everyone else?
Look, I think it's a good question. I mean, I probably spend way too much time on X. But look, I think X has done a very good job at feeding really interesting, like, content to me. So I owe a lot to X, you know, when it comes to kind of like staying on top of things.
The particular followers that...
Look, I think it's like a mix of founders working in the world of tech, you know, a mix of investors, personalities. Honestly, at this point, I follow, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 people. And so it tends to be just a really, really good stream of information.
How much time do you spend on X on average, daily, weekly?
Probably 30 minutes to like 45 minutes a day.
And is it just kind of like exposing yourself to what people are talking about?
Yeah, I think it's like it's exposure to what, you know, people are talking about. And, you know, if people are sharing interesting links, I'll go in and dive in. So, look, I mean, the reality is, you know, I spend a lot of time on X. I, you know, subscribe to a couple of kind of like newsletters, whether it's kind of like Ben Thompson's of the world, to kind of like keep on top of like what's happening in the world of kind of big tech. But yeah, it tends to be kind of social media. And then I think, honestly, it's pretty important to stay close to what younger generations are, you know, finding interesting. And so I spend time on TikTok and I'll spend time on Reels and I'll kind of try and dip in and out of the new kind of social product that is kind of getting hot at any given point in time. Because I think it lends itself well to kind of like keeping your mind fresh. And if you really want to back the future, you want to back companies that are going to be, you know, effectively be building products for, you know, people that are now like 10, 12, 15 years old. So
do you know any young people yourself personally? Like, do you have any direct exposure beyond TikTok to see what's trendy these days?
Unfortunately not.
Yeah, me neither. That's why I ask you.
No, but look, I think it's a good point. And I think it's a really important, you know, it's an important thing to have access to. Beyond my daughter, who's 15 months old, not really. And
so you got quite a huge rate. You got 15 months or
yeah,
quite a bit older than that.
But look, I mean, that's definitely one of the things that keeps me somewhat like paranoid. It's like being disconnected from what is actually relevant at any given point in time.
Yeah.
And I do think that if you're not plugged into a younger community, you have the risk of losing that.
Exactly.
Kind of like,
yeah, I definitely started noticing that. When you come across these new terms and music, and there's so many different points in just your day-to-day life, where you're like, I don't even know, like, you know, what's number one at the moment. You know, you have just these little moments in your life where you're like, I'm getting old. This happens to all of us.
Definitely.
It's really funny because my partner's just started his PhD, and he's an avid listener of the show. So shout out to him. And he always comes home and tells me about how the other PhD students are like 10 years younger than him. And it's his first exposure of people of that kind of generation. And it's just, you know, as an investor, linking it all back to like having a hand in what is on people's minds, what are people interested in, what are they talking about, as I said, beyond TikTok. All right, cool. So moving on a little bit, I wanted to come back to, you mentioned one of the exciting ingredients for, was it Fundamé? Is that how you pronounce them?
Yeah.
You were saying that they were showing organic signs of early traction. So that was a validation point for you early on. I was going to double click on what you look for, those validation points. So I'd love to hear a little bit more of a checklist of, like, you know, organic growth, like really specific metrics that's really clear to any founders listening to this. But then also I'd love to get into the post-investment, your portfolio companies at Local Globe. I'm sorry, so this is a double part answer. So I want to do a quick kind of checklist on the early signs of organic growth. And then I really want to hear about moments, discoveries, results that indicate that portfolio companies are like really on this hockey stick upwards trajectory. So there's kind of like a similar question, but for different stages of the business, if that makes sense.
Yeah, look, I think it's slightly trickier to put out a checklist, at least for me working at Local Globe, because we're a generalist fund investing very early. And so, you know, it's very hard to apply kind of like a broader blanket checklist, you know, for a company that might be building in consumer to a company that might be building in bio, because fundamentally you'll be looking at somewhat different things. And I think ultimately it goes back to what I was saying earlier. The two things we really, really look for are markets and absolutely exceptional outlier founders. And so on the market side, you know, we really want to understand, or we need to believe that there is a venture potential. Like, a big enough company can be built within the space, maybe not today, but maybe over the next 5-10 years, because the market will expand, that will, you know, justify us making an investment. So that's the first thing. And again, we'll kind of like do, you know, various work to kind of like get to that kind of like level, well, to get to conviction on that. And then on the founder piece, it's really trying to ask ourselves if we think this is the team to win. And again, it's kind of like thinking through the fit between the problem space and the founder's background, experience, unique insights, et cetera. But honestly, we spend like 95% of our time on market and team. And look, when there is traction, then we obviously lean into that as, you know, an additional point of validation. And that point of validation, you know, might mean the team can execute. It might mean that, I don't know, there's a lot. So look, I don't know if that answers the question, but it's very hard to apply a checklist. I think that's the first thing. I think post-investment, you were asking, you know, what we look for. Or what was the question exactly? It was
the results, the activities that you see that really demonstrate that they're going on that next stage of growth. So if you invest quite early stage, there are those initial kind of validation point, the organic growth you mentioned with Fundamé, the 150, whether it was, you know, newsletter signups, organic, social, yeah, you know, set those kind of channels. But then once they're kind of through the door, they're part of your portfolio, however long after, 6 months, 12, 18, however long later, what do you start to notice, if anything, where you're like, oh, okay, these guys are seriously, like, they're on this rocket ship?
Yeah. Look, I think post-investment, when we come in with Local Globe, things are still very early. And, you know, things are going to change, and they'll keep changing for several years. But, you know, one of the first things we do when we back a team is we'll sit down with them and we'll try to think through, you know, what unlocks the next round of financing. You know, how do we get to the next inflection point? The next inflection point typically means we go out and raise a Series A. And then we work back to kind of the present, and we try and set up a number of milestones that will kind of guide us, you know, through the next kind of 12, 18, 24 months. And so every quarter we sit down together in what we call a milestone meeting, which is effectively an informal board. And, you know, we'll kind of like have a very open conversation. Like, how do we think we're tracking towards that inflection point? Do we think we've set the right milestones, or do we think we need to kind of like change them? And, you know, if we think they are the right milestones and we've not hit them, like, why do we think that that is? And, you know, where can we support? And so, again, like, there's these dates in the calendar that we kind of like intentionally put in, and we work closely with the founders to basically ask ourselves that question all the time. I think the one thing that I find to be kind of like a commonality across all teams that end up doing very, very well is velocity on product. So being able to ship very, very quickly and not necessarily perfect code. That is like not the intention, but being able to ship very quickly to test hypotheses very, very quickly. Because that's effectively what you're doing at the early stages of company building. You're trying to answer, you know, questions, and you're trying to run experiments, because that's effectively what a startup is. And I think the journey from C to A, and frankly, the journey from like C to Series B, is just to get to a point where you have concrete answers to the questions that you laid out when you built or you started at the company. And hopefully by the time you get to kind of Series B, you know, the questions have answers, you feel confident with them, and you can raise a lot more money to just like plow in and grow. And so for me, like the real commonality really is velocity on product and speed of iteration. I think, yeah.
And so on the flip side of that, are there any other failings, stumbling blocks, hurdles, or is it literally just the opposite? Is it just they're not moving fast enough? Or do you witness anything else that's getting in the way of a company's success?
I think speed is kind of like basically kind of like touches what I just said. Like speed of movement is critical. And if you're not moving, you know, fast enough, you're probably dying. I think, you know, that's kind of like the first thing. I think there's many reasons that may be the case, right? So I think speed is a byproduct. I think your first hires are critical. And, you know, we think it's important to take time to make sure that you're hiring people that are genuinely, you know, aligned with the mission, are high performing, and want to actually like put the time to find the answers, right? I mean, building a company at the very early stages is just, it's very, very tough, right? Like I've not been in the founder seat, so it's hard for me to kind of like really comment, but I've been, you know, an employee at a kind of seed stage company, and it's grueling. It's really, really difficult. And you want to make sure that the first hires are willing to go through that like very, very painful process. And I think if you cut corners because you want to get going, you want to start building product, you know, I think that can have detrimental.
So how do you reconcile the importance of speed and the quality of talent?
It's a good question. It's honestly, it's a very good question. And it's one that we have, you know, chatted with many teams about. You know, we have seen teams that are like super obsessed about the quality of the talent that they bring on board, so obsessed that they've not hired anyone. And so I think you have to find a balance. And frankly, in my view, it comes down to your ability to hire. I think if you're very good at hiring, and that means knowing where to kind of source, and ultimately knowing how to sell people to come on the journey with you, you'll be able to do it. Now, again, it doesn't mean it'll take you a week, 2 weeks, you know, but it shouldn't take you 6 months. It shouldn't take you 12 months, at least at, you know, the very beginning. I mean, you should get that kind of like initial team going. And again, in most cases, when we back founders, I mean, one of the things that, you know, they'll talk to us about, and, you know, we'll certainly have conversations with them about, are the first kind of 2 to 3, 5 hires that they have in mind and who those people may be. Like that's something that will go very, very deep, because we know that, you know, taking 3 months, 4 months to find that first engineer, you know, again, is just going to massively slow them down.
It's a risk that you want to mitigate as much as possible, don't you? What have you observed from the greatest founders who've got it right on that hiring front?
I think, you know, being able to tap into very, very relevant pools of talent. And those may not be the most obvious pools of talent. So I guess the most obvious pools of talent for what they are building. So not necessarily saying I'm going to go to Google, Meta, Snap and hire engineers there, or, you know, ops people there, et cetera. It's really understanding where the best people in the world work and or are studying in and around the problem space that you are building in. Mm. So I think that's really, really important.
Does a specific example come to mind?
Look, I mean, I think, you know, I spent some time with an AI company, like AI infrastructure company, you know, last year. And they were very intentional about going to the best research institutions in the UK within their kind of like specific field, which happened to have been the University of Edinburgh and the University of Glasgow, which are phenomenal institutions for AI. But, you know, I think a lot of founders wouldn't immediately think about them. They'll think about, you know, Cambridge and Oxford, you know, and Oxford and Imperial. And so I think it's just really important to like think about what you're building, think about like the challenges, I think the technical challenges that you might need to overcome. And again, that's not relevant for every company, but for more technical businesses. And then try to think through like the pools of talent or the areas where the talent that is kind of like most closely linked to that problem space currently kind of like works at or studies at.
So remaining like open-minded to these other possibilities, these other routes to achieving.
Yeah, I think trying to find arbitrage when it comes to talent acquisition. Mm. I think most people tend to go to the same place.
Just like defaulting to the obvious.
Yes, I think, yeah, exactly.
The theme of sales has been a really big recurring topic on this podcast, as you can imagine. And it comes to mind here with the hiring front as well, in terms of attracting great talent. What have you observed in terms of charismatic founders? Because you're talking about, okay, the pools, where are they? We need to know, first of all, where are they hanging out? Where are we going to be, you know, hunting for these great, you know, these great individuals? But then you've got, on the flip side, what are we actually attracting them to? You've got a great mission. You've got all of the aspects that have helped secure the loot in terms of, you know, the fundraise. But in terms of talent, it goes deeper in terms of, who am I working with? Do I like the founder? Do I like the team? Can you speak to anything in terms of like what makes a really charismatic founder and helps them attract great talent? Mm.
Look, first of all, I'll say you don't need to like the founders person. Like, you don't need to be best friends with the founders that you work with. That doesn't mean they're not charismatic, but, you know, I don't think we necessarily as investors need to gel and be best friends with founders that we end up investing in. I think some people definitely kind of operate that way. They want to be very, very close. They want to become like close friends with the people that work with. I don't think that's kind of like necessary. In terms of charisma, I think, again, it's somewhat of a, I don't know. I think there's some level of objectivity to it. I think there's some level of subjectivity to it. I think in my view, it's really an ability to take you on the journey with them and help you see what they're seeing, not over the next kind of 12 to 24 months, but really where they see the world going 5 to 10 years in, and kind of like make it very easy to see the big picture.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the founders I tend to get most excited about have like a really, I think they just have a tendency to take very complex problems and distill them into something that, you know, a 10, 15, 16-year-old would understand, frankly, me, right? Like, just being able to, like, convey something complex in, like, layman terms and then help you see, like, a very, very kind of, like, big vision up ahead. And I think that ends up rubbing on people, right? Mm-hmm. It rubs on investors. It's easier to articulate that to your own team. It rubs on, you know, candidates. They can see kind of, like, the big vision, which is, you know, often needed, because at the beginning you have, like, a half working product. Like, it's very easy to kind of like get stuck into the details. You need someone that can take you on that journey over the long term to, you know, actually get you to jump ship and take on that risk.
And even just listening to you talk about that, I'm feeling excited, and I'm not even hearing the founder vision. I'm hearing it through you, but it's still getting me worked up. So, penultimate question, the time always flies with these interviews. I have a tradition of always ending with the same question, but I'm going to kind of remix it a little bit for you, because usually the last question on the show is often the best lessons come from the biggest mistakes, hence the title of, you know, Strategy and Tragedy. So, you know, what's a big mistake that's taught you an unforgettable lesson? But I think we've covered a lot of that, and you've shared a lot of what you've seen from your, you know, your side of the fence as the investor, what you've observed with your founders' portfolio. For you, what I want to ask in a similar sort of vein is, do you have an anti-portfolio? Are there deals that you regret not being able to get in on?
Honestly, I think I'm too early in my venture journey to comment on that. I think, you know, anti-portfolios get built over like 10 years.
When the results are in.
And so look, all I'll say is I hope I have an anti-portfolio. I hope I see companies that end up being very, very big because it means I'm seeing the right things. I think it's too early to tell what those are.
Interesting. So just to double click on that a little bit. So do you mean that you hope you have an anti-portfolio because it would prove your judgment correct?
It would improve my judgment correct. I think it's very hard to be correct at the early stages of kind of company building or investing. I mean, we're often in the wrong. I think it's important to say we're often in the wrong with our judgment. Like, we'll often say no. Like, our job is to say no, like, 99% of the time. And so by virtue of that being our job, we'll miss on a lot of things that end up being breakout. The reason I'm saying I hope there is an anti-portfolio is, you know, it ultimately proves that we're seeing the right sort of things. Even though we're saying no, we're seeing companies that are going to get very, very big. And ultimately, our job is to make sure we pick a couple of those very, very right.
Mm. Okay. Good answer. Not the juicy one I was hoping for, but makes sense. Very thoughtful and intelligent, as usual, consistent with you, Ziv. So final question, is there anything that you were hoping I would have asked you that I haven't? Anything we haven't already touched on? Because I feel like you've answered a lot of things that I was thinking of, but I feel like there's more in your mind to tap into.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in my mind. Nothing that comes to mind, yeah.
Okay, amazing. Yeah. All right, well, thank you so much for your time, especially very busy man with hundreds of LinkedIn DMs and thousands of emails that are waiting for you. So thank you so much for joining. And thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you've enjoyed it. Tune back in to next week's episode and we'll see you then.